So with the parsha of Yisro, Yisro himself takes the trip to join Bnei Yisrael in the Midbar. And the pasuk devotes, the Torah devotes a good few psukim to Moshe's reception of Yisro. And he tells him the whole story. Vayisaper Moshe lechosno, he tells him everything that happened. And Yisro is delighted. Because as sons-in-law go, Yisro feels he did well. And in pasuk Yud, of Perik Yud Ches, Yisro responds. Vayomer Yisro Baruch Hashem Asher Yitzid Eschem. Yisro starts Baruch Hashem, that's already about as Jewish as you can get. Asher Yitzid Eschem Miad Mitzrayim Umiad Paro. Baruch Hashem who saved you from Mitzrayim and Paro. Asher Yitzid Eschem Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim. Who saved the nation from the hand of Mitzrayim, from under the hand of Mitzrayim. And we note, just pausing on this pasuk for a moment, Yisro seems to have said largely the same thing twice. The first phrase is, Baruch Hashem Asher Etzil Eschem Miyad Mitzrayim Umiyad Paro, and then goes on to say, Asher Etzil Esam Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim. And what's the difference between the first half of the pasuk and the second half of the pasuk? It's about Hashem saving Bnei Yisrael. And here we see, interestingly, it's what seems to be a machlokas rishonim in Parshanut. For Rashi gives us one or two words of explanation for each phrase, and that's his way of showing us how they're different from each other. Commenting on the first phrase, Asher Hitzil Eschem Miyad Mitzrayim, Rashi says, Uma Kasha. It's a difficult nation, a hard nation to get away from. Umiyad Paro, Melech Kasha. Okay, I think we're all in agreement there. And with regards to the second phrase, Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim, Rashi quotes the Unculus and explains, Shayo Machbidim Aleim Es Ha'avoda. They laid very heavy work upon them. And really, if we distill from Rashi his approach to these two phrases, they really seem to represent two aspects of being saved from Mitzrayim. The first is being saved from the, shall we say, being under the jurisdiction or control of Mitzrayim. And secondly, from being saved from the work of Mitzrayim. Okay, so two elements of Hatzalah. That's how Rashi explains. Ramban, interestingly, understands that these two parts of the pasuk are referring to two different groups. The first phrase again says, Baruch Hashem Asher Hitzil Eschem, who saved you, and then Asher Hitzil Es Ha'am. Well, the Am, if the Am are the Jewish people generally, then who are you? Well, says Ramban, Eschem, you, refers to Moshe and Aaron. As if to say, Moshe and Aaron had their own dynamic with Paro. They had their own salvation from Paro. They basically went into the lion's den regularly to confront him, and therefore Yisro, perhaps family first, Moshe and Aaron, first and foremost, Baruch Hashem who saved you from Mitzrayim and Paro, and then beyond that saved the rest of the Am. So that's Rashi and Ramban. I'd like to suggest perhaps an additional interpretation of the difference between these two phrases, Asher Etzil Eschem and Asher Etzil Es Ha'am. And by way of introduction, let us go back to the first pasuk of the Parsha, which we all know, Perik Yud Ches, pasuk Aleph, Vayishma Yisro Kohen Midyon Chosen Moshe. We get his full credentials. It's his Parsha after all. And what did Yisro hear? Es kol asher asa Elokim leMoshe uliYisrael amo. Everything that Hashem did for Moshe and Yisrael, ki hotzi Hashem es Yisrael miMitzrayim. Now, there are a couple of interesting points, basic points in this first pasuk. Firstly, We note that B'nai Yisrael are referred to differently in the two halves of the pasuk. In the first half of the pasuk, it says, "What did Yisro hear? Es kol asher asar elukim leMoshe uli Yisrael amo." Moshe and Yisrael, his people. So Yisrael are referred to as Moshe's people, which I guess they are. The second half of the pasuk, as it reiterates, says, "Ki hotzi Hashem es Yisrael miMitzrayim." What are we to make of the initial reference to B'nai Yisrael as Yisrael Amo, Yisrael Moshe's people, and subsequently just Yisrael over there? Largely the same thing. Secondly, and perhaps more pressingly, what exactly is the final phrase of the pasuk doing? The first half of the pasuk says, "What did Yisro hear? Es kol asher asar elokim leMoshe Yisrael Amo." He heard everything that Hashem did for Moshe and Yisrael. Well, what is everything? It sounds like everything, which means there isn't really anything excluded. That being the case, for the pasuk to conclude in the way that it does, it almost seems to funnel drastically the whole news that Yisro heard, because Ki hotzi Hashem es Yisrael miMitzrayim seems to limit it. I mean, if you start with everything and then you end up with one thing, you've restricted. So what did Yisro hear? Did he hear everything? Did he hear one thing? Did he hear both? I mean, both are still part of everything. And these are basic parshanut questions with regards to even to pasuk aleph. Well, I believe the answer may be in Rashi's comment in the beginning of the pasuk, the famous Rashi, "Vayishma Yisro," Yisro heard, and Rashi voices the question. It's from the Gemara in Maseches Vachim, Daf Kuf Tet Zayin, "Ma Shemua Shoma Uba." What did he hear? What did he hear that he came? And the answer, says Rashi, is two things: Kriyas Yamsuf. He heard about Kriyas Yamsuf. I mean, that's a big draw, and Milchemes Amalek, also the war with Amalek. Interestingly, we're not going to so much go into it, but important to note, we mentioned that Rashi sources the Gemara in Zvachim Kuftet Zayin. If you look in the Gemara there, you will see that Kriyas Yamsuf and Milchemes Amalek are two different opinions. Some say Kriyas Yamsuf, others say Milchemes Amalek. There's yet a third opinion there in the Gemara which says Matan Torah. Rashi doesn't go near that. That's part of the question as to when Yisro came. But what's interesting is Rashi amalgamated these two opinions. He made them fluid. Kriyas Yamsuf, Milchemes Amalek. He doesn't give us to understand that they're in competition with each other. They can be combined, certainly for Rashi's purposes, and that's that. But what's very interesting is the Rashi would be much easier to understand if we never read the pasuk. Because if the pasuk just says Vayishma Yisro and you're wondering what he heard, so then Rashi says, well, he heard this one thing and then he heard this other thing, and now we know that he heard two things. Except we can't forget that the pasuk said he heard everything. So Rashi seems to be a third idea. The pasuk itself gives us two things that he heard, starting with everything, which sounds like you can't add to that, and ending with Yetzias Mitzrayim. And Rashi starts like we never heard any of this and says, well, what do we imagine that he heard? Two things, Kriyas Yamsuf and Milchemes Amalek. B'chol zeh omer darsheni. Well, as you can appreciate, this is one of those Rashis where everyone has said something about it. And, well, we are no exception. I think that part of what's happening in this Rashi is that we take something for granted. Namely, or Yisro perhaps took something for granted. He feels that B'nai Yisrael are a stellar people, and he feels he'd like to come and join them. Very nice. We're familiar with that concept. It's possible for someone who's not born Jewish and he can become part of the Jewish people. We call that Geirus, and that for us is part of Torah. But the question is, how does Yisro know? In other words, you can hear everything you want about Yetzias Mitzrayim and about Hashem's relationship with the Jewish people and the things that he's done for them, and you can admire it and you can be impressed by it. None of that should give you to understand that you can actually become one of them. I mean, that's a leap. I mean, it's literally a leap of faith. How do you know? And that's really the question. And perhaps one can say that's Rashi's question. Ma shemua shoma ubar. You can hear it and stay at home in the sense that, well, that's the Jewish people. I wish them well. I think they're doing wonderful things. What's it got to do with me? The notion, it's such a jump. Could you become Jewish? Well, how do you know? But Yisro obviously does know, otherwise he wouldn't have come to join them. And that's why, although the Pasuk talks about what Yisro heard, Rashi's question is, what did he hear that he came? Ma shemua shama uba. Well, the answer is two things, Kriyas Yamsuf and Milchemes Amalek. And the reason why is because all the events of Yetzias Mitzrayim, they don't help Yisro with this question, because they're about saving Bnei Yisrael from their oppressors and punishing the Mitzrayim. They're all nisim. But what does that say about whether you can become Jewish? Nothing. However, as we know, and we referred to this a couple of weeks ago, the Pasuk tells us, V'gam Erev Rav Ala Itam. When Bnei Yisrael left Mitzrayim, they were joined by other people, the mixed multitude, Erev Rav. So what's very interesting is Yisro will actually display a very keen interest in the experiences of this Erev Rav, because he wants to become part of the Erev Rav. I mean, he wants to be like them. So really the question is, well, how were they received? I mean, no one stopped them from coming, but as if to say, what type of treatment did they get? How can you tell? Well, you can tell, because look at the nisim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu performed for Bnei Yisrael, and see whether he performed them from the Erev Rav as well. It is an indication as you'll get. So it's interesting, because actually, as Bnei Yisrael went through the Yam Suf, three groups went through the Yam Suf. The natural-born Yisrael in the front, Mitzrayim in the back, and the Erev Rav in the middle. And two of those three groups came out, Yisrael and the Erev Rav. Mitzrayim were drowned. But let us not forget, I mean, the Kriyas Yamsuf, the sea is being held open artificially by a miracle. But that miracle was performed not only for Yisrael, but also for the Erev Rav. That's the first indicator for Yisrael, as if to say, if Hashem treated them more like Yisrael than he did the Mitzrim, perhaps they really did succeed in becoming like Yisrael, and maybe I can too. And the second is Milchemes Amalek. Yesh Omer, that when Amalek attacked, the Pasuk says they attacked from behind. If they attacked from behind, they'd probably hit the Erev Rav first, because the Erev Rav traveled behind. Which is interesting, because the entire retaliatory war was therefore done in response to an attack on the Erev Rav. And that for Yisro is full confirmation. That means that they are considered to be part of the fold. They didn't really pay their way at the critical junctures, but nonetheless they're given every opportunity. And therefore Yisro hears about these post-Yetzias Mitzrayim events that involve not only Bnei Yisrael but also the Erev Rav, and that confirms for him he can join as well. Ma shemua shama uba. Now we mentioned in Parshas Bo that the approach of the Zohar HaKadosh is that whenever the term Am is used in distinction to, in contrast with, the term Yisrael, it is a reference to the Erev Rav. And therefore, let us suggest firstly that this is the difference between the reference to Yisrael Amo and Yisrael. Pasuk Aleph mentions firstly Yisrael Amo, and secondly Yisrael. And the way to read the Pasuk according to this is that Yisro heard Eskol Asher Asar Lukim LeMoshe UliYisrael Amo. He heard everything that Hashem did for Moshe and Yisrael Amo, Yisrael his people, that is expanded Yisrael, Yisrael including the Erev Rav. He did all of those things for Yisrael Amo, ki when, says the Sforno. Ki does not mean here for, but rather when Hotzi Es Yisrael Mimitzrayim. As if to say, when you put the Pasuk together, when Hashem took Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim, he performed miracles for Yisrael Amo, Erev Rav included. That's Kriyas Yamsuf, Milchemes Amalek. And therefore, in light of the above, if we go back to Pasuk Yud, perhaps we can see in a new light what Yisro is so, why he responds the way that he does. Pasuk Yud Vayomer Yisro Baruch Hashem Asher Hitziles Chem Miyad Mitzrayim Umiyad Paro Asher Hitziles Ha'am Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim. Firstly, Baruch Hashem that he saved you. And who is you? You, according to this approach, is you, the Jewish people. And Yisro is very happy about that. Moshe is the leader of the Jewish people. But he gives special mention to another group of people. Asher Hitziles Ha'am Mitachas Yad Mitzrayim. Because the Am is the Eruvah, who were also pursued by Mitzrayim, who were also saved. And they are a group which is of particular interest to Yisro, because he wants to become one of them. And that's Eschem versus the Am. Natural born Yisrael versus the Eruvah. So these are some thoughts with regards to these opening psukim in the Parsha. The center and centerpiece of Parshas Yisro, of course, is Matan Torah. And Matan Torah begins with a number of means of preparation. Not only are there means of preparation, and they are referred to in Perek Yutes, Pasuk Yud. Perek Yutes, Pasuk Yud. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Lecha La'am, V'kidashtam Hayomu Machar. So go to the people, Kidashtam, prepare them, separate them, prepare them today and tomorrow, just to timestamp things. This was taking place on the 4th of Sivan, and therefore, V'kidashtam Hayomu Machar, get them ready today and tomorrow, V'chibsusim Losam, they should clean their clothes. According to this reckoning, if we're talking on the 4th, and this Hayom Machar, which is the 4th and the 5th, then the Yom HaShlishi, the projected day for Matan Torah, ostensibly is the 6th of Sivan. However, we find later on in Pasuk Tesvav that Moshe gives what seems to be a different message to Bnei Yisrael. Pasuk Tesvav, Vayomer La'am, Heyu nechonim l'shlosh yamim. Be separated, be prepared for 3 days. Now, the question is, are Moshe's shlosh yamim the same as what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said? It's possible, even though it's not exactly the same phraseology. And Rashi does quote that possibility second. But the first possibility, and it is a machlokas in the Gemara, in Masechet Shabbos, in the 9th Perek, that actually HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them 2 days of preparation and Moshe added on a third. Hashem said be ready today and tomorrow, get yourselves ready, but Moshe says you need to get yourselves ready for 3 days. The question is, where does the third day come from? The Gemara says, Moshe hosif yom echad midato, he added on another day. Except, I mean, that takes some doing. What's the basis? And the Gemara explains that what Moshe did was he applied what's known as a hekesh. And briefly, what a hekesh is an equation, a halachic equation. It means that when two things are mentioned together in the pasuk, they are considered to be equated one with the other. You learn one from the other. Okay, how does this relate to us? Well, the words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Pasuk Yud were Kidashtam Hayom Umachar. The time for preparation is called Hayom Umachar, today and tomorrow. Now, let's watch carefully, because today and tomorrow are about to shift a day. How so? HaKadosh Baruch Hu always speaks to Moshe in the morning, and therefore Moshe reasons through this hekesh that today and tomorrow must be the same. They must be equal. So, well, tomorrow, how much of tomorrow will be spent in preparation? The whole thing, not only the evening, but also the following day. If the tomorrow of today and tomorrow is a complete day, then also the today of today and tomorrow must be a complete day. The problem is, that discounts today, because we're already halfway through. It's already the morning, the night's already happened. And therefore, applying the hekesh equation of Hayom Umachar, if you need 2 complete days, that means that today and tomorrow starts tomorrow. And therefore, they ended up being preparing themselves on the 4th, and then the 5th, and the 6th. Wow. Okay. So that we see the Derabbanan here, it's part of the of Matan Torah from the outset. But Tosfos ask a very interesting question. It's almost like it's difficult to know how to place this. Don't forget that the Gemara labeled this idea of Moshe as Midato. It was his idea. The problem is, by the time you finish explaining it, it sounds so good, it doesn't even sound like it's his idea anymore. In other words, it should be done. That's how you darshan Torah. As if to say, I mean, that's what it's there for, the Midrash HaTorah and the Drashas Bahem. Shall we say that every time a drasha is applied, that's called midato? That's not midato. Midato sounds like it was his idea. This wasn't his idea. On the contrary, if he got it right, it's the Torah's idea. So why is it called midato? So in other words, the strength of his argument actually raises questions in terms of the way it's presented by the Gemara. The better it is, the less midato it is. Of course, the worse it is, that's no good, because we don't want it to be worse. Except how do these two live together? It's a hekesh, it's a bona fide drasha, and still it's called midato. That's an interesting question. That's a Tosfos question. Tosfos, faithful to their credo, accompanying us throughout Shas, never to get carried away. Whenever the Gemara speaks, you've got to watch it carefully, and if it looks good, make sure it isn't too good, because then it's not midato anymore. Well, some suggest as follows. We mentioned a couple of weeks ago a yisod of the Hafla of Reb Pinchas Halevi Horowitz from his Sefer on the Torah, Panim Yafos, in Parshas Noach. And he maintains that what is well known to us as to how the day goes, that first you have the night and then the day, by Erev, by Yivoker, that, number one, is true only for Yisrael. It's not true for Umos HaOlam, for nations of the world. And number two, even for Yisrael, it is only true post-Matan Torah, not before. Beforehand, even for us, first came the day and then the night. As the Pasuk says in Parshas Noach, the Yom, the Laila, lo yishbosu. First Yom, then Laila. We spoke about this through the Malbim in understanding how the Pesach in Mitzrayim went. Okay, what are the implications for our question? Well, let's come back to the situation. Moshe says they've been told to get themselves ready, Hayom Umachar. That discounts today. But why does it discount today? Because part of today has already gone. Which part? Last night. But that itself is an interesting question. Is last night part of today? In other words, in terms of the way the days have configured until now, last night is part of yesterday, because Yom V'Laila means the day starts in the day and then ends in the night, which means you could have two full days, the fourth and the fifth, because their nights will follow them, in which case the sixth could still be the third day. So there doesn't seem to be a basis for Moshe's drasha anymore. But the point is, here comes the idea of Midato. The Midato, the initiative of Moshe Rabbeinu, is to launch Bnei Yisrael already at this stage into the way of reckoning the days, whereby first is the night and then the day. That's the Midato element. Once you do that, now your way is clear to make the drasha. Because if it's true, if you have elected to configure the days in that way, then today has to be discounted, because last night is part of today. It has already happened. But that's Midato. So we see the very delicate combination of what is Moshe's initiative and what then remains or becomes a full-fledged drasha. That's a very interesting approach that some mafarshim take. Although recently, having been involved quite extensively with Reb Kupperman's Sefer on Pshuta Shemikra, he has another suggestion, which is also very fascinating. And that is as follows. Our question was, Moshe made a drasha, so that's called making a drasha. That's not called midato, that's not called your own idea, that's called the Torah's idea. You're darshaning it. Except, says Rav Kupperman, there's just one thing we need to remember. When we talk about, and this is bichlal, a major question, the transmission of the Torah, Matan Torah. As we know, Torah is given, or has two parts to it, Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebalpeh. And what we need to bear in mind is that when we talk about the giving of the Torah, we're not always talking about the same thing. The two were not given at the same time. There are different places in Shas where they talk about how the Torah was given. They're talking about different parts of Torah. For example, when we say Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai, and you have the famous machlokas as to whether Moshe received only the general Torah generally, Klalim at Sinai, or maybe even Klalim Pratim at Sinai, that is with reference to the contents of the mitzvahs. That's Torah Shebal Peh. The mitzvahs of Torah are Torah Shebal Peh. That doesn't touch on the question as to when Moshe received the text of Torah Shebichtav, what we call the Chumash. That is a separate question. There is no way that one can say, as much as we say Moshe received the entire Torah from Sinai, that he did not receive the entire Chumash at Sinai. Because if he did, that means that he received what, from Bereishis to Le'enei Kol Yisrael. So if he read it, he'd find some very interesting things. Like, for example, Bnei Yisrael were quite soon about to make an eagle. And also that he was going to hit the rock. And all of this, of course, is impossible. Moshe does not receive Torah Shebichtav until after it's happened. And even there, there's a well-known machlokas in Gittin and Daf Samach as to whether did he receive it in installments after it happened, what is known as Megillah Nitna, installment by installment. Or perhaps he only received the whole thing at the end. Chasuma Nitna, Mamish at the end he received the whole Chumash. But certainly, in real time, as things are happening, as much as Moshe receives the contents of the mitzvahs, perhaps even down to their details, klalim upratim, but the text of the Chumash is something else. That waits till later on. So, so Rav Kupperman raises a very simple point. Drushes are for Torah Shebichtav. You darshan psukim. You don't darshan mitzvahs. You can't make a gezeirah shava, for example, from one mitzvah to another. You can only make a gezeirah shava from one pasuk to another. And so it is with all these other things. Which puts us in an interesting situation. Here we are saying, Moshe darshan, Hayom is like Machar. We see Hayom and Machar in the pasuk in front of us. But Moshe didn't have it in the pasuk in front of him when it was told to him. When he heard the words Hayom and Machar, he's hearing them from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're not being dictated for him in the Torah. So Moshe does a very unusual thing. He's the only one in our history who applied Midas Shatar Nidreshes Bahen to the spoken word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when it wasn't even a pasuk. And how can he do that? Well, the answer, says Rav Kupperman, is he's Moshe Rabbeinu. That's the Midato factor. The Midato here is that Moshe is able to hear words from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and know already at that time which words that are pasuk words that in the fullness of time will find their way into psukim. We may posit not everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe ever became a pasuk in the Torah. Plenty of things Hashem said to him there are not. We find them in the Medrash and we have Masoras about them, which means the fact that Hashem speaks to Moshe doesn't make it drash worthy. Because you don't know, is this a pasuk? Will this be a pasuk? But Moshe's sense of hearing already can detect the potency of words from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those are pasuk words. They're not a pasuk yet, but they will be, and he's already darshing them in advance. That's quite something. That's one for the books. And that's how Rav Kupperman understands that although the methodology that was pure drash, classic drash, but the notion that it could be applied to Hashem's spoken word, that's midato from Moshe. So these are very interesting, not only interpretations of this Rashi, but they raise and remind us of important questions as well with regards to Matan Torah, Torah Shebichtav, and Torah Shebal Peh. I'd like to move from here to the Aseres HaDibros, and I'd actually like to focus on the last one, although, of course, encourage you to read the first nine as well, but our discussion will be on the last one, which is Lo Tachmod. Not to covet, the final of the Aseres HaDibros. And although it seems rather straightforward, no tachmo, someone has something, don't covet it, as we will see, it's not so straightforward, which sometimes happens. The leading question with regards to the aveira of lo tachmod, of coveting, is voiced by the Ibn Ezra. And that is, how can the Torah tell me not to desire something? How can the Torah tell me not to want something? The Torah could tell you not to steal, but can the Torah tell you not to want? Can the Torah tell you that belongs to someone? It looks nice, you'd like it, don't like it, don't would like it. That's a little difficult. A person feels what they feel, wants what they want. The Torah can say, you're not allowed to do anything about it. That may well be. But how can the Torah tell you not even to want it? Well, the Ibn Ezra gives a famous answer. In fact, it's so famous, some people don't know that it's the Ibn Ezra. They think it's a medrash or something like that. It's the mashal of the kfari, of the villager. And what's the mashal? Says Ibn Ezra, you know, if there's a princess who's passing through town and you have this this villager, this commoner, he would never feel, you know, I'd really like to marry her, because she's so many leagues removed from him and what's possible for him, it just doesn't occur to him, which is an interesting thing. Many of her courtiers would very much like to marry her. How do they differ from him? He understands that she's just too far removed from what's appropriate for him. That's interesting, says Ibn Ezra, because you see a certain mindset, in a sense, nullifies feelings of, oh, I'd like that object or that person or whatever it is. Says Ibn Ezra, really, a person should be looking to develop a sense of hashgacha, whereby everything that belongs to someone else is like that. If it's his and not yours, so leave it alone. It's for him and not for you, just like the princess is for a prince and not for this person. And on the contrary, says Ibn Ezra, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if it belongs to someone else and Hashem says leave his property alone, so then that's even more removed from you. And that's the answer of the Ibn Ezra. It's a very interesting answer, and there's a lot to ponder there. Because the Torah isn't moving towards the final point as if to say, you like that thing, stop liking it. But rather, it's really pulling it back to the root, as if to say, the way you look at other people's things, that your paradigm, right, your map of how you understand other people's possessions vis-a-vis yours, they should be as much removed for you as the princess are for the villager. And then the tachmid will evaporate. So says Ibn Ezra. The Ksava Kabbalah has, in a sense, a similar approach, but slightly different track. Because the Ksava Kabbalah explains that really what's being the mindset behind lo tachmod is really about a person's values, shall we say, generally. And if the Torah is saying to the person, you need to ask yourself, what do you want out of life? What's your goal in life? Your goal in life is to amass as many possessions as you can. You'll look at everybody else's things and you'll desire them. But the Torah really is saying, but you should have higher goals than that. In other words, as surely as a person doesn't desire things that are trivial or beneath him. So really the Torah is saying, other people's possessions, it should be beneath you to be the object of your desire. You should be occupying yourself with loftier goals. That's how your orientation should be. And if it is, so these things will be beneath you to desire them. Okay, so Plonio something, what's it got to do with you? I mean, that's the object of your attentions. Your attention should be fixed elsewhere and upwards. That's the Ksava Kabbalah's approach. What the Ksava Kabbalah has in common with Ibn Ezra is that he concurs that really what the Torah is demanding of you is to develop a mindset whereby coveting someone else's things is redundant or will naturally fall away. That's the point. The focus is not on the coveting. It's on the way you look at either people's possessions or the way that you look at life. So what's very interesting is one could almost say, certainly for the Ksava Kabbalah, is that although we put lo tachmod in the category of ben adam lachaveiro, for sure, don't covet a person's things, but the mindset that really makes it possible is the Ben Adam Lamakom mindset. In other words, you should have good Jewish goals, godly goals, and then you won't value other people's possessions. So it's very interesting, because the fuel, right, the engine room for lo tachmod, the way what's meant to set you on your way here, is ben adam lamakom. But when you do, then naturally ben adam lachaveiro in that respect will sort itself out. That's very interesting. But what's also worthwhile mentioning is that the Ksava Kabbalah seems to have given us a very broad scope or reach of lo tachmod. You see, an important question about lo tachmod, coveting other people's things, is what does the person have to want to do in order to violate this prohibition? It seems there's room to say for the Ksava Kabbalah that if someone has something and you're jealous of them and you'd also like something like that, but that's lo tachmod. So what if they have it and you don't have it? Okay, so you also want one. But the point is, according to this approach, lo tachmod is just whatever they have, you'd like to have. It doesn't mean you'd like theirs. You just have to like to have one like that. So lo tachmod, so if your friend lives in a mansion in Beverly Hills, or if he lives in a rooftop apartment, and so according to the Ksava Kabbalah, that's not the thing that should be occupying you. I'd also like a mansion. No one ever spoke about whether you want their mansion or their apartment. They can stay there. You'll take the one next to them. You can be friends. So for the Ksava Kabbalah, the Tachmud, in a sense, it's broadened, because it's actually not so much coveting that person's item to take that item from him, but rather it's about having an equivalent item. You covet it in the sense that you want to be his equal. Rabbeinu Avram ben Arambam emphatically states in his Perush, we have his Perush on Bereishis and Shemos, that lo tachmod, as the pasuk itself, and the simple reading seems to imply, lo tachmod is really about coveting the object that the other person has. I want that one. I want his to take it from him. That's what it's all about. It's not enough that he'll have and I'll have one like that. I want his as well. That's lo tachmod, which is a major statement. There is a concept, for example, of keeping up with the Joneses. And according to the Ksava Kabbalah, life is not about keeping up with the Joneses. Okay, so Mr. Jones has that, and you've got that, and to try and be equal. Whereas for Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam, lo tachmod is about taking Mr. Jones's things. I want that one. I should have it, and he won't. That's a different shape, in a sense, of Isser. Well, from here, we do need to take the discussion a step further. And this, I believe, is not so well known. It's what you'd really have to call the halachic definition of lo tachmod. And by that I mean the way the Gemara discusses it and the way it's paskin halacha. I mean, mitzvahs have halachas. At what point does a person violate lo tachmod? So I don't know if this is so well known. It might be a bit of a surprise. But it's very clear in the halacha that you haven't violated lo tachmod until you've actually acted on it and taken the object from that person. That's the way the Gemara says in Bava Metzia and Daf Hei, and Rambam paskens it in the Mishnah Torah, that lo tachmod, the violation of lo tachmod, is that someone has something and you pressure them. You can ask them if they'd like to sell it, but if the answer is no, but the answer is no after two or three times, you cannot then stand on their toes until they sell it to you. And if you do, at that point you violated lo tachmod. That's very interesting. And in fact, really what the Gemara is saying is lo tachmod hasn't happened until you've actually taken it. Some say that support for this definition of lo tachmod comes from a pasuk in a couple of weeks' time. The Torah tells us when you do aliyah l'regel, don't worry, your things will be fine. Lo yachmod ish es artzecha. No one will covet your land when you're away. You'll be fine. When you come back, you'll find that everything is still there. The famous haftacha, lo yachmod ish es artzecha. Well, say Mefarshim, what does that mean? If lo tachmod means just to desire it, so then why is the pasuk saying when you're away, no one will desire your land? That actually seems to be a negative statement, because why won't they desire your land? You're not there. It almost reflects badly on Eretz Yisrael. It's there for the taking, and no one will be interested. Lo yachmod ish es artzecha. No. Lo tachmod means, lachmod means to desire it and take it. They may desire it, they won't be able to take it. Now, That's how Rambam explains lo tachmot. And we'll appreciate that according to this definition of lo tachmot, the Ibn Ezra's question, in a sense, has fallen away. Because the Ibn Ezra's question was, how can the Torah tell me not to desire something? Or if I desire it, I do. It could say, tell me not to take it, but how can they tell me not to desire it? Well, according to the Rambam, it isn't. It isn't telling you not to desire it. It's just saying, don't follow through on that. And maybe you desire, maybe yes, maybe no. So the way the halacha frames lo tachmot, actually, it seems to accept the question of the Ibn Ezra, because the violation is a point beyond that. So that's very interesting. But we're not out of the woods yet. And the reason why is that we have two presentations of Aseres HaDibros and Lo Tachmod, that is to say, we have in this week's Parsha, Parshas Yisro, and later on in Chumash Devarim, Parshas Vayitzchana. And there are certain differences between them, and there are significant differences in the final Dibur of Lo Tachmod. Specifically, in Parshas Yisro, the phraseology used is Lo Tachmod. Okay, Lo Tachmod, but in Parshas Vayitzchana, it says Lo Tachmod, and then says, V'lo tis aveh, from the word ta'ava. Now, the question is, what is the difference between lo tachmod and lo tis aveh? It's a question that you have a few months until you have to worry about, because if it's just Parshas Yisro, all you see is lo tachmod, but be prepared, because come the summer, and Parshas Vayitzchanan, you'll see lo tachmod and lo tis aveh. What's the difference between them? Well, Rambam says the difference between them, actually take it. But v'lo tis aveh is when you're even thinking of taking it. That's a separate isser. In fact, not only is it a separate isser, the Rambam codifies lo tachmod and lo tis aveh as two separate los assays in the Torah. Numbers 265 and 266. So the full picture now, by the time we're finished, is not only lo tachmod, which is to desire and follow through and take it, but even just that desire to take it. But if that's true, then actually the question of the Ibn Ezra returns. It's just directed towards a different phrase. Because the Ibn Ezra's question is, lo tachmod, how can the Torah tell you not to desire something? You can't help what you feel. And the answer is, no, lo tachmod isn't until you take it. Fine. Lo tachmod is answered. What about lo tis aveh? Lo tis aveh says you can't desire to take it. So we just bought ourselves just a little bit of time until we read further in the pasuk. And now the question of the Ibn Ezra is back. However, we should know that even the higher or the further prohibition of lo tis aveh is not subject to the Ibn Ezra's question. And the reason why is because the way the Rambam formulates lo tis aveh, this is all in the Hilchos Gezeila, kol hamis aveh beso o ishto v'keilav shel chaveiro, anyone who desires someone else's things, kevan shechashav b'libo, as soon as he's begun to think, heyach yikna davar zeh, how could I buy that from him? V'nifta b'libo b'davar, and he's really given in to these types of schemes and plots, avar v'lo taaseh, as soon as he starts plotting and scheming, he's violated lo taaseh, shenemar, v'lo tis aveh. So what's very interesting about that formulation of the Rambam is that even lo tis aveh, says Rambam, hasn't been violated by the thought alone, the desire alone. It's not violated until you make something of it, until you start plotting and scheming, and that already you can control. The question of the Ibn Ezra is, if you want something, you can't help it. Quite so. But at that point, things should stop. But if you take things further, begin plotting and scheming, that's already beyond what you can't help, because you know you shouldn't do that, and therefore that's lo tis aveh. Even lo tis aveh is free, so to speak, or beyond the reach of the Ibn Ezra's question. And by the way, I believe the Rambam's formulation of lo tis aveh, it's rooted in Pshuto Shamikra. And the reason why, it's very interesting that lo tachmod, not to covet, as with most Isurim, is a kal, in terms of diktuk, in terms of Lashon HaKodesh. It's a kal. Don't do it. When it comes to desire, the Torah doesn't say lo se'aveh. Don't desire it. And that expression does exist in the Torah. Ki se'aveh nafshecha le'echol basar. The Torah never says los aveh, it says losis aveh in the reflexive. But why is this prohibition presented in the reflexive? Well, the answer, I think, is because the original ta'ava either occurs to you or it doesn't, and the Torah isn't addressing that. But are you misaveh? Misaveh in the reflexive means you begin to develop it and make a plot out of it, a scheme out of it. Le'avos? Either yes or no. Can't be helped, apparently. But le'hisavos, that's something else. Don't make anything of it. Leave it alone. Thought occurs to you, nothing you can do about that. Don't take it any further. And if you do, that's called le'hisavos. So I think it's mamish miushav in the precision of the phraseology of the pasuk. At any event, it's worthwhile mentioning a fascinating aspect of Lo Tachmod here. And that is, the question may arise, why? Why can you not be chomed someone else's thing? As if to say, let's take the Gemara's definition. Someone has an object, you really like it, you're prepared to buy it from there, they just don't want to sell it, but you pressure them until they sell it, and in the end they do, and the halacha says, that's a lo sase. The question is, why is it a lo sase? I mean, if we may ask, as if to say, it doesn't sound very menschlich. It doesn't sound like that's the edel thing to do, or the ehrlich thing to do, but at the end of the day, you did pay them. So, it doesn't sound like an aveira, but it is. But why? So the Rambam quotes the Michilta of Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. And the Rambam says, Hachimud may be l'dei gezel. Chimud, that type of l'tachmod approach, the heavy-handed pressuring buying approach, could lead to stealing. Why? Because you've already made up your mind, you absolutely must have it. You'll do what it takes. If he's prepared to sell, very good. If not, it may reach a certain point. What if he absolutely doesn't want to sell, but you're already so fixated about it? So says the Rambam again, his source is the Michilta of Rav Shimon ben Yochai. So what does the Rambam... But it's interesting that the Rambam tells us this in Mishnah Torah, as if to say, he's already told us the halachas. He's already told us, l'tachmod, you can't do that. We already know what gezel is. But then the Rambam says, you know, l'tachmod could lead to gezel. Is that a halacha? That's good to know. Is that a halacha? It's a halachic statement. Because this really tells us that l'tachmod is osur, so that you shouldn't come to steal. The Torah forbids pressuring a person beyond what's reasonable in order to make them sell, which is itself isn't stealing, but it's one step away from stealing. Because as soon as you get it into your head, you've got to have it, you're one step away from stealing. And the Sefer HaChinuch says likewise, as he discusses Lo Tachmod, it's a harchaka from gezel. Very interesting. And the reason why it's interesting, aside from the understanding, is that we're familiar with the concept of siagim, of preventative measures. Siag la-Torah, su siag la-Torah. Certain things are forbidden that you shouldn't come to do something else. But generally speaking, it's the Rabbanon who develops siagim for the isurim of the Torah. As if to say, the isur Torah is the isur itself, and the Rabbanon will make a siag, you shouldn't come to it. Rarely do we find that the Torah makes a siag itself for its own isur. And that itself becomes another one of the Tariag mitzvahs. We find it once in a while. The Torah, for example, says it forbids the king to have too many horses. Lo yabar lo susim, but lo yashivas ha'am mitzrayma. But there's a relationship between the two. The problem is, the issa, the prohibition of having too many horses, is that he shouldn't come to violate the other prohibition of taking people back to Mitzrayim. So that's a relationship within Torah of siag to issa, and they're both the araisa. That's the siag la Torah, min ha-Torah. And there are another couple of examples as well. And yet here is another example of that. That's lo tachmod, the way the Rambam is presenting it, The problem with the Tachmud is that it could lead, the Torah asked it, so you shouldn't come to the Isra of Kesel. That's a Chiddush. And there is a further Chiddush. The reason why there's a further Chiddush is because the Rambam begins by saying, Hata'ava mevi aladei chimud, vachimud mevi aladei gezel. Ta'ava, desiring it, leads to chimud, this forced sale, and that could lead to gezel. And now we have a most unusual situation. Because it seems, because let us not forget, that according to the Rambam, lotis aveh is a separate isser, it's a separate losase in the Torah. So we just finished working out why the Torah assert lotachmot, a forced sale, you shouldn't come to steal. But now the question, but why did the Torah even assert the planning as a separate lotase? Well, Rambam explains, they're in a line, A will lead to B and B will lead to C. Ta'ava, you start planning, you could follow through on it. And if you do, and it doesn't work out, you may steal. But the reason why that's so significant is because it appears that in this instance, we have discovered not only what you could call a siyag la Torah, min ha-Torah, a protective prohibition against a prohibition, but we actually have a siyag le siyag la Torah, min ha-Torah. The Torah set up two protective stages that you shouldn't come to the Isra of Gezel. And that certainly is an unusual situation. Interestingly, as we talk about Lotachman and Lotis Aver, there are implications for another question. The fact that the Rambam rates or reckons them as two separate losases, implications for another question. You see, we may potentially take something for granted. And that is, as we know, the Aseres HaDibros are presented twice in the Torah, as you mentioned, Parshas Yisro and Parshas Vayeshana. And there are differences between them. The question is, what is behind those differences? If they are presenting the same thing, how can they present the same thing in different ways? So I believe the conventional answer, the common answer to this question, is that actually these two presentations of the Aseres HaDibros really reflect two different versions of the Aseres HaDibros. Because as we know, there were two sets of luchos, right? The luchos Rishonim, luchos Shniim, and they're two different sets, and then they had two different nuschaos on them. And therefore, what you'll see in Parshas Yisro corresponds to the Luchos Rishonim, and what you'll see in Parshas Vayeshanan, slightly different, corresponds to Luchos Shniim, because Luchos Shniim was slightly different than Luchos Rishonim. That, I think, is the straightforward answer. But it is not so straightforward, because nowhere does the Torah itself tell us that what it's presenting in Parshas Vayeshanan is the second set of luchos. On the contrary, if anything, the second presentation of Aseres HaDibros is set within the context of remembering Mamad Har Sinai. It really sounds like it's about the original receiving of the Torah. One could be forgiven for understanding that even in Parshas Vayeshanan it's presenting the first set of luchos. But the only question is, well, if that's true, how do you account for the differences? If it's the same thing, how can it be different? But the answer may be something else. And some Rishonim take this approach. The reason why it's different is because it's in Sefer Devarim. And part of what Moshe does in Sefer Devarim, as it says in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Hey, is Ho'il Moshe Be'er Es HaTorah Hazos. He began to add Bior to the Torah. And therefore, says Ramban, as does Maharal in Tiferes Yisrael, that what one could say, that if you find additional words and phrases in Parshas Vayeshanan, it's the same luchos. It's just Moshe's added biur to the Aseres HaDibros, just like he adds biur to all of Torah. Very interesting. That's another possibility. The reason why I mention this is because it's very clear that the Rambam's position is the first way, that the Aseres HaDibros and Parshas Vayeshanan are the second luchos. Why do I say that? Because the second luchos contain a phrase which is not in the first luchos, lotis aveh. And Rambam says, lotis aveh is a separate losa. Now, if the words lotis aveh were, which do not appear in Yisro, but do appear in Vayeshanan, are there because they're words of biur of Moshe, words of biur of Moshe do not a lotase make. There's no way that adding words of explanation can beget another lo sase. Lo sase has come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Moshe, but not from Moshe, and certainly not from Bior of Moshe. And therefore, if the Rambam says these extra phrase lo tis'ave is another lo sase, it's because it's coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. It wasn't there in the first one because these are two sets of luchos, and that I believe is quite clear evidence that the Rambam subscribes to the first view. The two presentations are reflect the two sets of luchos respectively. So we've discussed the Isser of Lotachmod and from a number of angles, but there's one angle that really became apparent to me this afternoon. And that is through the words of the Medrash, Medrash by Yikra Rabba. And it's at the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim. Parshas Kedoshim, as we know, has this kind of a special status, as Rashi says, Bahakel Nemra, Daber El Koladat Ben Israel. It's read publicly. And the question is, why is it read publicly? Rashi says, Shekol Gufei Torah, Harbe Gufei Torah, Torah Tuluyim Ba. Many, many major principles of Torah, of course, which they are. But there is another explanation in the Medrash Rabba. And the Medrash says the reason why Kedoshim is read publicly is because it really corresponds to the Aseres Hadibros. And of course the Aseres Hadibros were given as public as can be, and therefore Kedoshim, which is almost like a reiteration of the Aseres Hadibros, also publicly, and the Medrash proceeds to show how each of the Aseres Hadibros has a parallel in Parshas Kedoshim. And the truth is, as soon as you mention that, many of them are very, very clear. If they both have Shabbos, right? Zochor Yom Shabbos Lekadsho, Eshav Sosai Tishmeru. They both have Kibud, right? Kabedes Avicha V'Semecha, Ishim Oviv Tiro. Right? The Medrash goes through each one. And the final Dibur, Lotachmod. Where is Lotachmod mentioned in the Kedoshim? What's its parallel? Says the Medrash. Lo tachmod, uksiv hocha, ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. If you're looking for the echo, if you're looking for the Parshas Kedoshim resonance of lo tachmod, you'll find it in ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. And I believe it's such an amazing thing, because in a sense, this is the first, shall we say, ben adam l'chaveiro vision that leads you to lo tachmod. And what a vision it is. Because really what the Medrash is saying is, lo tachmod doesn't just mean, listen, if Plony has it, and you don't have it, so then forget about it. Or you shouldn't be thinking about such things. And along comes the Medrash and says, no, you know what a tachmod is really all about? If Plony has it, you should be happy for him. Leave it with him. What a thing to say. Lo tachmod, you shouldn't desire it because you should be happy that he has it. Wow. That's a completely different plane of lo tachmod. On the contrary, you should want it to stay by him. You should be happy. Plony has it. And I was put in mind of something my father, Zatzal, said, quoting the Kotzker Rebbe. It's a very Hasidish rendition. But it's mamish this point. We say in Pirkei Avos, Eizu Ashir Asamech Bechelko. And who's rich? Someone who was happy with his lot. Okay, and there's plenty to be said, just al derech hapshat, happy with what you have, says the Kotzker Rebbe, Eizu Ashir, you know who's the one who's richest of all? Hasameach b'chelko. He's happy with what the other person has. The other person has it, and I'm happy for him. Sameach b'chelko. There's no richer person than that, because everyone has. And then he'll not think to take it from them? Why? Why spoil his happiness? And this is a way of looking at the Lotachmod, which really takes everything to a completely different plane. And we're mindful, and with this we'll conclude, of what the Rabbi Yosef Salant says in the Be'er Yosef. Rashi tells us that when we stood at Har Sinai, it says, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar. Vayichan, in the plural, in the singular, they encamped as one. And Rashi says, Ki Ishechad Belei Bechad. That's the introduction to Matan Torah. Why is it so important to be Ki Ishechad Belei Bechad in order to receive the Torah? You could explain on many levels, but the Be'er Yosef says, that part of the reason is because if you're not ki'ish echad b'lev echad, you can't really receive Torah because there's a lot about Torah that you won't really understand. There's a lot of mitzvahs in the Torah. They won't make any sense to you if you're not Ki'ishecha b'lei v'chad. And an example brings us back to here, L'tachba, the Torah says, be happy for him. Why should I be happy to him? He's somebody else. No, Ki'ishecha b'lei v'chad. If you have that mindset, the Torah will make perfect sense to you. So that's the call of the Torah to be like that, to have that vision, to be sameach b'chelko shel acherim, and then we will be richest of all. We'll leave it over there.
Gentlemen, we have an exact minion of 10 men.